Hello, and welcome to Entertainment Weekly. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Every week, I read from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is EW.com. I have a pretty good mix of articles this week, some reviews, some, of course, our must list, an interesting birthday list. I'll give you a preview. It was Cher's birthday this week as I'm reading this. So let's start with that must list. Friendship, a new Lilo and Stitch, and Dulé Hills in Lights Out, Nat King Cole, top this week's must list. A foodie meets ghost story novel and a Netflix murder mystery starring Megan Faye round out our picks for the weekend. This is by the Entertainment Weekly staff. As someone who is perpetually cold, I am very grateful summer is almost here, and what better way to kick off the sunny season than our summer TV preview? From our cover story on the final season of Prime Video's The Summer I Turned Pretty, to exclusive photos from the upcoming Outlander prequel series, Blood of My Blood, there's plenty to get you excited to, well, stay inside even though the weather is nicer. But hey, at least no risk of sunburn. That's Patrick Gomez, editor-in-chief. The first item on the list is Friendship. Writer-director Andrew Young didn't write his new film with I Think You Should Leave star Tim Robinson in mind as the lead, but fans of the cringe-inducing comedian's shtick won't leave the theater disappointed. The former SNL writer plays Craig Waterman, an awkward middle-class suburbanite who eagerly befriends his new neighbor, Austin Carmichael, played by Paul Rudd, a confident TV weatherman with an enviable social life. But when Craig commits a bizarre faux pas at a party, Austin politely ends the relationship, inadvertently sending his unstable new neighbor down a self-destructive spiral. Lilo and Stitch is next. Maya Kealoha brings precocious star power to her version of Lilo alongside an adorably lifelike computer-generated Stitch in one of Disney's best live-action adaptations yet. But it's the film's themes of sisterhood and family that make it a must-see, and they spell it S-E-A for the must-see. Sirens. Whenever White Lotus's Megan Fahey visits a swanky location, you know there's going to be trouble a-brewin'. This 5-episode Netflix limited series may be a murder mystery, but it's also a study of the effects of trauma. Bonus, Julianne Moore serves hella C-wordy cult leader vibes. Lights Out, Nat King Cole. Dulé Hill is exceptional as the classy crooner in this inventive off-Broadway play set right before taping on Cole's final variety show episode. Co-written by Coleman Domingo and Patricia McGregor, this show, which features an epic tap battle, truly is unforgettable. Aftertaste. Combine the bear, top-tier food writing, and a ghost story, and you get author Daria Lavelle's latest book about a man whose power to taste the favorite foods of ghosts leads him towards disaster and a complicated love story. That's our must list for this week. Friendship, a new Lilo and Stitch, and Dulé Hills in Lights Out, Nat King Cole top this week's list. And that was by the Entertainment Weekly staff. We have a couple reviews. This first one is 9 Perfect Strangers. Season 2 isn't worth the trip. Nicole Kidman leads a new cast of strangers seeking psychedelic therapy in Hulu's anthology series based on Leanne Moriarty's bestseller. This is by Kristen Baldwin. The first season of 9 Perfect Strangers premiered 4 years and a lifetime ago in the summer of 2021. Based on Leanne Moriarty's 2018 book and starring Nicole Kidman as a mysterious Russian wellness guru, The limited series was weird, narratively wobbly at times, but ultimately entertaining, bolstered as it was by an excellent cast, including Melissa McCarthy, Michael Shannon, Regina Hall, and Bobby Cannavale, and the signature snappy flair of showrunner David E. Kelley. Moriarty's book ended, but the show did not. Much like HBO, which is still hoping to squeeze more monetizable blood out of Big Little Lies, Hulu chose to reanimate Strangers for another batch of episodes assembled by new writers. Kelley is still listed in the credits as creator. While Kidman's Masha is back, this time lording over a group of needy and neurotic folks in the Bavarian Alps, the dull and draggy new season, which premiered May 21st, has little of the humor and emotional weight that made the original worth watching. Years after dosing a bunch of people's smoothies without their consent at her Tranquillium House resort, Masha Dmitrychenko is a global celebrity, the inspiration behind a best-selling book called Nine Perfect Strangers, and the target of several federal investigations. When her former mentor Helena, played by Lena Olin, invites her to run a retreat at Zuberwald, her sprawling mountaintop resort, Masha agrees, partly to evade subpoenas and partly to test her groundbreaking new psychedelic delivery system that she says will allow patients to revisit and reprocess formative memories. Her new subjects converge on the winter wonderland, boasting all manner of dysfunction. Brian, played by Murray Bartlett, is a former children's TV show host reeling from a public scandal. Depressed piano virtuoso Tina, played by King Princess, is hoping for a relaxing spa vacation, though her smothering girlfriend, Wolfie, played by Maisie Richardson Sellers, has other plans. Peter, played by Henry Golding, wants to reconnect with his aloof billionaire father, David, played by Mark Strong. Former nun Agnes, played by Dolly de Leon, seeks absolution for something in her past, and wine-guzzling Grand Dame Victoria, played by Christine Baranski, arrives with her handsome young lover, Mateo, played by Eris Aiden, in tow, much to the chagrin of her estranged daughter, Imogen, played by Annie Murphy. Overseeing them all is Helena's wary assistant, Martin, played by Lucas Englander, who is there to place quote-unquote boundaries on Masha's methods, lest Zuberwald become the center of another headline-making debacle. The original Nine Perfect Strangers came loaded with the early revelation that Masha was using psychedelic drugs to force her patients to confront their emotional wounds. In season two, Masha's subjects and viewers know her methods, so the writers must try to find new ways to surprise us. Masha announces that she's carefully selected each member of the group for maximum therapeutic effect, and over time it's revealed that they're all connected by more than just psychic trauma. Other mysteries involve Masha's history with Helena and the real reason she invited David to Zuberwald over Helena's fierce objections. Meanwhile, Peter and Imogen bond over their neglectful parents and begin a tentative romance, and everyone spends their days tripping as Masha's protocol progresses. Expect multiple scenes of the characters engaging in psychedelic frolics and freakouts, some of which illustrate their backstories through sweaty, surreal vignettes. Watching other people get high isn't all that interesting, so it's up to these backstories, the wounds each stranger came to Zuberwald to heal, to keep us engaged and invested in the story. As each episode progressed, I kept thinking back to the first season and the devastating speech Napoleon, played by Michael Shannon, gave about his son at the end of episode 3. For me, as a viewer, that was a watershed moment. This show isn't perfect, but I need to see what happens. This time around, that moment never came. There's a flatness to the writing that leaves the characters feeling like types rather than people, And despite the talented cast, moments of emotional resonance are rare. Bartlett gives the most compelling performance as Brian. The actor evokes the pain of his character's crushing regret, resentment, and grievance as a man redefined publicly as the worst thing he's ever done. And Brian's burgeoning friendship with Agnes, after their acquaintance gets off on an extremely awkward note, is one of the most effective arcs in the series. An underused Baranski delivers her usual dazzle as Victoria, and Kidman once again commits fully to the steely Russian enigma known as Masha. Swanning around in a chic platinum bob and offering her clients guidance in the form of comically vague doublespeak, Masha is a character with a capital C. Season 1 leaned into the camp elements of its scheming heroine, but this season is darker, tonally and literally, as all the action plays out against a backdrop of a slate-gray Bavarian winter. Though the 8 episodes are peppered with twists, including one late reveal that feels recycled from Season 1, 9 Perfect Strangers forgot a key ingredient for its storytelling smoothie. Fun! Dramas about the unhappy upper classes need some degree of comedy to make them palatable. Otherwise, it's just a bunch of self-serious one-percenters complaining about their bespoke trauma. TV doesn't need that, and viewers don't need the diminishing creative returns that result when networks insist on reconstituting old ideas rather than supporting new ones. A humble suggestion for the folks who make television: one book equals one season, period. As Masha tells her clients, this won't be easy and it might be painful, but you will grow from this. The first 2 episodes of 9 Perfect Strangers Season 2 premiered Wednesday, May 21st on Hulu. That was the 9 Perfect Strangers review. Season 2 isn't worth the trip, and it was by Kristen Baldwin, who's giving the show a grade of C. Lilo and Stitch is next, and we heard about that on our best list. Live-action adaptation is a whimsical, heartfelt upgrade. It's also cute and fluffy. This is by Maureen Lee Lanker. Ohana means family. Family means no one gets left behind. That seems to be Disney's motto when it comes to adapting their animated hits into new live-action vehicles, though they do appear to be pumping the brakes, to varying degrees of success. Blissfully, the 2002 film Lilo and Stitch gets an adaptation that is vibrant, whimsical, and earnest, and also cute and fluffy. Perhaps it's the fact that Lilo and Stitch has always been an outlier in the world of Disney animation, coming as it did with the last gasp of the studio's renaissance. Mashing up Hawaiian culture and sci-fi lore, it tells the story of Experiment 626, a dangerous and chaotic alien who crash lands on Earth. It's not a Disney princess movie or even a mythos-steeped tale like The Lion King, Mulan, or Hercules. Instead, it's a quirky movie about found family, connection, and the importance of finding one's people. Stitch, as 626 is renamed by precocious and lonely Lilo, played by Maya Kealoha, was created to sow destruction, but he flourishes under Lilo's loving and anarchic care. At its core, this new version of Lilo and Stitch, which hits theaters Friday, is the same as its animated predecessor, but most crucially and surprisingly, it's also interested in telling a deeper story that shades in much of Lilo and Nani's grief with colors that imbue the project with a glorious richness. Part of this is undoubtedly the work of director Dean Fleischer Camp, who's best known for directing the equally charming and melancholy Marcel the Shell with Shoes On. Camp takes the wackier aspects of Stitch's antics, including his penchant for tearing things to shreds and desire to eat anything he sees, and he tempers them with the heartbreaking stakes of Lilo and Nani's situation. As wild or gross as Stitch gets, he never fully extinguishes the thread of melancholy woven through the film. As in the original film, Nani, played by Sidney Ndong, is Lilo's sole guardian following the death of her parents. While parental loss is a frequent theme in Disney films, it is Camp's poignant direction that brings the hurt and confusion of that into the foreground, making Stitch a healing figure in Lilo's life as much as she is in his. Screenwriters Chris Kikanioliani Bright and Mike Van Ways wisely divide the social worker assigned to Lilo's case and Agent Cobra Bubbles into two distinct characters. Tina Carrere, voiced Nani in the original film, brings a sensible compassion to Mrs. Kikioa, a social worker who is less looming villain and more genuine civil servant. Meanwhile, Courtney B. Vance employs his stern dramatic chops in his take on Cobra Bubbles, a CIA agent tracking Stitch and other signs of extraterrestrial life, all while never losing a playfulness that underpins every choice he makes. Zach Galifianakis and Billy Magnuson revel in their ridiculousness as evil scientist Dr. Jumba and researcher Agent Pleakley, respectively. Magnuson's unhinged glee at the vagaries of Earth is comedic gold, while Galifianakis deploys his trademark deadpan effectively as the film's true antagonist. Honestly, I would watch an Odd Couple spin-off about these two trying to adjust to life as humans any day of the week. Magnuson in particular seems to relish being a goofball to an utterly disarming degree. Still, none of this matters without the film's central sisterly bond between Nani and Lilo, which Ndong and Kealoha effortlessly bring to life. Kealoha is a star in the making, every bit as mischievous, intelligent, and wise as the character she's playing. Even as a kid, I found the animated version of Lilo to be an irritating brat who needed a good time out, or 10. But Kealoha offers Lilo a wellspring of sadness and aching loneliness just beneath the surface of her more impish qualities. With a twinkle in her eye, Kealoha makes it clear that much of Lilo's bad behavior stems from her grief and inability to make sense of it. As Nani tells her, Lilo's not bad, but sometimes she does bad things. With Kealoha inhabiting the character, that finally feels true. Kealoha is matched by Adong's charmingly exasperated, deeply loving take on Nani. Given a deeper backstory, including deferred college dreams, Nani gets to be her own person, beyond merely the put-upon sister plunged suddenly out of her depth. The genuine love and care between Ndong and Kealoha radiate off the screen, which amplifies our emotional investment as viewers. Kai-Pu Du Doit's slightly nerdier take on Nani's love interest, David, has a similar effect, elevating him from hunky surfer to charming, if also bumbling, heartthrob. And Hannah Waddingham gives a good stern space lady as the voice of the Galactic Grand Councilwoman. But what would the movie be without its Stitch, animated to adorably fluffy effect in this more realistic rendering? Now 3D rather than mere pen and ink, he looks instantly huggable, so much so that I can't even begrudge Disney the thousands of stuffed Stitch toys this is bound to sell. Chris Sanders, who co-wrote the 2002 film and voiced Stitch then, returns to the mic, and the intervening years have only made Stitch's now iconic closed-throat vocalizations more resonant and affecting. We dare you not to melt when he woefully declares, "Stitch bad." And his final speech about the family he found, little and broken, but still good, pulls ever so tenderly at one's heartstrings. Tying all of this together into a lay of sorts is the film's crucial non-speaking character, the Islands of Hawaii. it's impossible to ignore the impact of the film's setting. Lilo and Stitch has always been a love letter to Hawaii, its people, culture, and environment. While the movie isn't a musical in the same sense as many of the animated classics, it captures the musical traditions of the islands in its soundtrack. Getting to showcase all of those things in live action rather than lush animated renderings makes this the rare outing from Disney to outstrip its original version. Now, we actually get to take in the ocean views and tropical vistas that Lilo and her family call home. We're in the waves with Nani and David as they surf. Camp utilizes the locations to their fullest advantage, immersing audiences in the abundant natural beauty and, by extension, the place that Lilo and eventually Stitch call home. Despite its intergalactic trappings and setting in paradise, Lilo and Stitch is a movie about things far more relatable to our daily lives than daring adventures or happily ever afters. This new iteration brings the film's powerful themes front and center, particularly in its climax, which trades some of the animated film's spaceship theatrics for a sequence that touchingly highlights Stitch's bond with Lilo and the goodness it has cultivated in them both. Here, it's less a Hawaiian roller coaster ride and more a winsome feel-good flick about what it is to find one's family and to, in turn, be found. That's the Lilo and Stitch review. Live-action adaptation is a whimsical, heartfelt upgrade. It was by Maureen Lee Lanker, who's giving the movie a grade of B+. Our last review is Fountain of Youth. John Krasinski and Natalie Portman fail to find treasure in this weak tea adventure. Guy Ritchie's latest is too violent for kids and too stupid for adults. This is by a staff author. Pee-wee Herman brought us to the basement of the Alamo. Guy Ritchie's new globetrotting quest brings us to the basement of the Great Pyramids. And I think after watching both movies, most people will agree to stick with Pee-wee. On paper, Apple TV Plus's Fountain of Youth seems like a fun idea. A mix of National Treasure and The Mummy with a bickering John Krasinski and Natalie Portman as brother and sister tomb raiders. That right there, the sibling connection instead of a typical on-again, off-again partners in romance, is proof that at some point during this film's gestation, there was a hope to create something original. Unfortunately, there is an uncanny lack of urgency in the film. The characterizations are flat. The would-be quippy dialogue rarely elicits laughs, and the action sequences seldom rise above the level of satisfactory. Ritchie's closing credits boast a production that went around the world, Thailand, Austria, Egypt, and more. A lot of effort went into this, but the movie still feels like a light snack instead of a full meal. We open with Krasinski's Luke Perdue evading baddies in Bangkok on a scooter, a leather pouch slung over his shoulder. He's stolen a painting, and as bullets whiz past his head, he's on his earpiece to his hacker sidekick, played by Laz Alonso, helping him find an escape route. Gee, Indiana Jones never needed one of those. When he thinks he's made it to safety, he discovers someone else on his trail, a tracker played by Aiza Gonzalez, whose mission seems to be to stop Luke from whatever he's doing, but also somehow to protect him. She exudes Ardeth Bay vibes from The Mummy with some secret sacred protection mission. Once Luke is free, he's off to London because his scheme needs his sister Charlotte, played by Portman. The problem is she's given up the family's adventuring past and taken a stable job as the curator, as if there is just one, at the National Gallery in Trafalgar Square. Luke yoinks a Rembrandt off her wall, ensuring she loses her job. Truly a jerk move, but this at least gets her attention. The reason for all these thefts? As in the Da Vinci Code, there are secrets in the masterpieces, and if you collect them all, you'll find the next clue to the location of the Fountain of Youth. And here you thought it was in Florida. But Luke and his team, which also includes Carmen Ejiongo, can only take things so far. They need Charlotte's keen mind to connect the dots. Funding the expedition is the zillionaire Owen Carver, played by Domhnall Gleeson, a chipper gent who we discover is dying of cancer, so he needs to drink from this fountain ASAP. The hidden clues soon take them on a wild goose chase. The first stop is the Lusitania, which has been at the bottom of the ocean for a century. But Owen has the dough to raise the ship from the depths so they can do a little plundering. After a big, wet fight scene, Gonzalez and her gun-carrying crew show up. The next clue leads them to the Austrian National Library, an ornate structure that, naturally, is rife with hidden rooms. Each step reaching the cockamamie goal gets increasingly dangerous, and Charlotte keeps threatening to tap out, especially since she's got her kid tagging along. But Luke knows that she yearns for a life of thrills, and no matter how many risks he takes, she does indeed keep coming back. And here's where I say that for me, Krasinski, whom I usually like, kind of fumbles the ball. Being a careless jackass, but also irresistibly charming, is a tough needle to thread. Believe me, my wife reminds me. Not everyone can pull this off. As I watched Fountain of Youth, I kept thinking, they should have gotten John Hamm. Portman does her best too, but the part is written as a bit of a weakling. Her big joke is saying, "No way I'm doing that." And then we cut to her doing that. It's a gag that worked on I Love Lucy, but I don't know how much it works today. It's a shame because it's been a very long time since Portman has given a good performance in a successful mainstream film. Don't get me wrong, she's done some substantial work in the last 10 years. Jackie and Planetarium and Annihilation and May December come to mind. But the Star Wars prequels in the first round of MCU pictures were her last monster hits, and she deserves more. The movie ends exactly how you think it's going to end, but there's a strange tonal mismatch in the film's third act. Portman's dopey kid, I'm pretty sure he's wearing shorts, takes more of the spotlight as the movie begins to rely on special effects. And yet, all the other factions, not just the Protectors and Thai mob, but Interpol too, are blazing their machine guns at one another, racking up a body count. It's like the movie doesn't know whether to break PG or R, so it does both. If you were a 13-year-old in 1990, dropped off at the mall multiplex with Milk Duds money, Fountain of Youth would be a big win. Today, with infinite options on other streaming platforms, not to mention video games, it's hard to imagine that too many people will be gulping this one down. That was the Fountain of Youth review. John Krasinski and Natalie Portman fail to find treasure in this weak tea adventure. It was by a staff author who's giving the movie a grade of C. We're about midway through already, and I will mention that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is Entertainment Weekly, and I am reading from their website, which is EW.com. Next, I'm going to read the top story that was on the website when I pulled it up. Alexander Skarsgård breaks down Murderbot's relationships, recalls how he fell in love with the rogue android. The actor also teases the SEC unit's biggest nightmare. This is by Shania Russell. Murderbot is full of surprises. Despite having a name that reasonably invokes fear, The android at the center of the new sci-fi series is more interested in watching soap operas than making good on the promise of its name. Shocked? Well, so was Alexander Skarsgård. I was so surprised when I started reading the script because it was such a different character from what I expected. Skarsgård, who plays the titular sec unit, tells Entertainment Weekly, "I did not expect the socially awkward android who prefers to be left to its own devices and watch soap operas. It was such a refreshing, unique character, and I just fell in love with Murderbot." Skarsgård adds that the role was especially intriguing for its quirky, lighthearted tone. Having just embarked on an anguishing revenge quest in The Northman and embraced hedonistic horror in Infinity Pool, the new series from Chris and Paul Weitz was a nice change of pace. Based on Martha Wells' best-selling sci-fi saga, The Murderbot Diaries, the 10-episode series follows a security robot owned by a futuristic megacorporation that is rented to protect the crew of a space exploration mission. But unbeknownst to them, Murderbot has freed itself from its enslavement, hacking its programming so that it has the ability to disobey orders. Rather than earn its namesake by using said freedom to go on a killing spree, Murderbot decides to just quietly binge TV shows. But it's not all fun and games and soap operas for Murderbot. Along with continuing to do its job, the SEC unit finds itself going through some serious existential changes. It's a character who is, after hacking its governor module and gaining autonomy, or free will if you believe in such a concept, is forced to confront its own humanity in a way it hasn't before, Skarsgård continues. And I found that really interesting as a character study. What happens when these things come up to the surface? How is Murderbot responding to that? Is it trying to kind of suppress it or approach it? And what scares it? What excites it? This is where the soap operas come in. The Rogue SEC unit has a favorite show, The Rise and Fall of Sanctuary Moon, a Star Trek-esque space romp starring John Cho, Clark Gregg, and Jack McBrayer, and DeWanda Weiss, in outrageous costumes and even wilder storylines. I think The Rise and Fall of Sanctuary Moon is, in a way, more than just entertainment for Murderbot. It's almost like an anthropological study, Skarsgård says. I think Murderbot is watching humans and human interaction through the show because it feels it's safe to watch it. Then it can do whatever it wants. It can pause and it doesn't get sucked in. It doesn't get involved, as opposed to the humans that it gets to know in this season. He continues, when they try to pull Murderbot in, that's a lot scarier because you can't just press pause. You're kind of in it yourself, and that scares Murderbot a lot. But it is also quite intriguing. Not initially, but I think it slowly starts to build a firmer connection with these humans and care about them. The 2-episode premiere sees the SEC unit assigned to protect a group of space hippies that it immediately deems incompetent. Preservation Alliance leader Dr. Ada Mensa, played by Noma Dumasweni, and her team of scientists, Garothin, played by David Dasmalchian, Rathi, played by Akshay Khanna, Bharadwaj, played by Tamara Podemski, Arida, played by Tatiana Jones, and Pin Lee, played by Sabrina Wu. While Murderbot claims to have little interest in the weird human crew and keeps making asides about its plans to abandon them, it can't help but jump in when they face danger. It is perplexed and confused by the humans, Skarsgård explains. It's talking about this adventure that it's going to go on, and it's just kind of procrastinating. All right, well, when the time is right, I'll take off and leave them to their own devices. But then they're so naive and they're not equipped for this environment they're in, and they're in way over their heads. Along the way, Murderbot forges some significant connections. Used to being mistreated by humans, the SEC unit doesn't expect the kindness it receives from Mensa, a thoughtful and empathic leader who is the most insistent about keeping Murderbot around for protection. As much as it prefers to be left alone, somehow, subconsciously, there's a deep gratitude and appreciation for someone who actually sees Murderbot for who it is, Skarsgård notes. Then there's the kindness that Murderbot receives from Rathi, whose attempts to befriend the SEC unit only seems to unsettle the android. Rathi wants to be buddies with Murderbot in a very kind of sweet but awkward bro-y way, Skarsgård says, and that is so disturbing to Murderbot. Unnerving as Rathi's friendly demeanor may be, it's nothing compared to Garathin, an augmented human whose ability to perform computer functions with his brain makes him the most suspicious of the SEC unit's functionality. Skarsgård insists that while the tension between the two is palpable, Garathin was never meant to function as an antagonist. He's very suspicious of Murderbot, but not for any selfish reasons, Skarsgård says. He's fiercely protective of Mensa, the team, but especially Mensa. So I thought it was a very interesting relationship because Garathin is the only one in the team who could potentially find out that Murderbot has gone rogue. And there lies the kicker, because the more endeared Murderbot becomes to its humans, the closer Garathin gets to figuring out the truth. And that is Murderbot's biggest nightmare, Skarsgård teases. New episodes of Murderbot hit Apple TV Plus every Friday through July 11th. That was Alexander Skarsgård breaks down Murderbot's relationships, recalls how he fell in love with the rogue android. It was by Shania Russell. Here's something exclusive to Entertainment Weekly and from their summer preview. Alien Earth star intros the new lead. I don't even want to try to compare my character with Ripley. Sydney Chandler takes the reins of the Alien TV series as Wendy, a hybrid, a child whose brain has been infused into a robot's body. This is by Nick Romano. Sydney Chandler knows she's impulsive at times, but in the case of Alien Earth, it landed her the job. The actress, previously seen in the film Don't Worry, Darling, and the FX miniseries Pistol, got her hands on the script for the Noah Hawley TV series based on the world of the Ridley Scott horror films. Her father, actor Kyle Chandler from Friday Night Lights, is the resident World War II buff of her family, and her mother, Catherine, is a history nerd. But Chandler, 29, has always been the sci-fi fan with her nose in some kind of genre novel. She heard Holly, who was busy with FX's Fargo, was filming in Canada. So as soon as she finished reading the script at 2 a.m. one early morning, she booked a flight to go find him that very day. I called my agent and I was like, "Where's Noah in Canada? And do you think there's any possibility he would let me take him to dinner so I can talk to him about this show?" Chandler tells Entertainment Weekly. Noah, for some reason, said yes. We chatted for a really long time about story and character and why I felt so drawn to this Wendy character. Audiences will meet Wendy on Alien Earth in the timeline of 2120, just a few years before the launch of the USCSS Nostromo spaceship from 1979's Alien. In this not-so-distant future reality that's full of synthetics, human robots with artificial intelligence, and cyborgs, humans with artificially enhanced body parts, Wendy is a hybrid, a robot infused with human consciousness. More specifically, she has a child's brain in a bot's body. Prodigy, one of five corporations that now govern the entire world, Weyland, Yutani, Lynch, Dynamic, and Threshold are the others, is the IP owner of hybrids, including Wendy. Hawley further describes his vision of Earth in a separate interview with Entertainment Weekly. Let's just say the climate predictions are coming true. It's a hotter, wetter planet. If we just extrapolate where we are now, it's driven much more by corporations than democracies. It's very much wrapped up in a competition for technology superiority. The nature of power is, in the end, there can be only one. So we're in the middle of a battle on that level for who has the power in the human race. Wendy and the hybrids play into that power struggle, but she physically gets in on the action when a Weyland-Yutani spaceship crash lands in Prodigy City. She and her fellow hybrids are sent to investigate the site, leading to the encounter of mysterious life forms, including one ferocious xenomorph. We started working with the mechanics of how these kids would move physically, and Noah took us more into the mindset space, Chandler says, of stepping into her role as a hybrid. What is the essence of a kid or a young adult? How do their minds work differently than the adult mind? Kids are so present, and they haven't been battered by the world as much as an adult, so they trust their gut, and they don't second guess. Timothy Oliphant, who worked with Hawley on Fargo, also comes into Wendy's orbit as Kirsch. Hawley declines to divulge much about the character other than to say, the look was his idea. Hawley continues, it's a very different role for him, but it does play on something that I find so exciting about him as an actor, which is he lives in that space between hero and villain in a really interesting way. When he's playing the hero side of it, he's the best guy to strap on a gun and go to high noon. Babu Cisse, known in the U.S. more for Free Fire and Killer Heat, plays another mystery character. He's definitely related to how the creatures come to this world, Hawley says, but in the franchise's grand tradition of fierce sci-fi heroines, first established by Sigourney Weaver with Ripley, Chandler's Wendy remains at the forefront of what Hawley describes as a very big, oversized, dramatic story. I don't even want to try to compare my character with Ripley, Chandler remarks. It's just impossible to do. But I hope people like Wendy as much as I love her. She's my favorite character that I've ever been able to play. Hawley elaborates, I feel like the Alien franchise has a female identity, both with Ripley's character in the films and then, of course, the fact that the aliens themselves are matriarchal. They have a queen. It feels very much like a female-focused show. Sydney's character is someone who's trying to figure out what her role is in this world and, on some level, the age-old question of, does humanity deserve to survive? One of the most memorable moments from 1986's Aliens for Hawley is Weaver's line, I don't know which species is worse. You don't see them effing each other over for a goddamn percentage. This idea of the horrible things that we do to each other, Hawley continues, Sydney plays a somewhat innocent character who finds herself trying to navigate two kinds of monsters. One is human, and the other is from outer space. We do expand on that idea that it's going to be up to the audience which species is worse. Alien Earth will premiere Tuesday, August 12th, with the first two episodes dropping on FX at 8 p.m. Eastern Time and Pacific and on Hulu at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. One new episode will then premiere each following Tuesday. That was an Entertainment Weekly exclusive about Alien Earth. The star intros the new lead, and it was by Nick Romano. And I promised Cher, happy birthday, Cher. Her birthday was May 20th, her 10 most iconic moments. Only 10? This is going to be tough. This is by Jordan Hoffman. Singer, actress, activist, indecipherable social media user. There are many contours to share, but perhaps this is a time when an overused phrase really is applicable. Living legend. 79 years ago, as of May 20th, the woman born Cheryl Sarkisian came into this world, and it's impossible to imagine the pop culture landscape without her. She's won an Oscar, an Emmy, a Grammy, is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and as the goddess of pop, she has sold over 100 million records worldwide. Let's add another 40 million when you include her work as duo with Sonny Bono, with whom she starred on a successful television variety show. And of course, we can't forget about her successful concert tours and highly lucrative Las Vegas residencies. In addition to those achievements, there is her stature as an activist, particularly in the LGBT community, and concerning animal rights. Indeed, just last week, Cher was crossing swords with the Los Angeles Zoo on behalf of two elephants. Through it all, Cher has remained a woman with an incredibly sharp wit and zero tolerance for BS. To list a mere 10 iconic moments is a fool's errand, so don't get too upset when we don't include your favorite. Apologies for leaving out her performance in Come Back to the Five and Dime, Jimmy Dean, Jimmy Dean, and I Got You, Babe, but that was a Sonny and Cher song anyway. This is her day. Our number 10 is Super Trooper. Cher's appearance in Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again in 2018 remains her last substantial film role. We can and must keep hope alive that something else is out there on the horizon. But if not, we'll at least have the big finish scene in the clip that's linked in the article, in which Cher leads the entire cast, including Meryl Streep, through a rousing rendition of Super Trooper. The only reason this doesn't rank higher on the list is that it is Cher in salute of ABBA. The long view of history suggests that future films will include legendary performers celebrating Cher. Number 9 is Silkwood. This also has a link in the article. In the early 1980s, Cher was in a precarious place in her career. She tried to transition from pop and disco to rock and roll, and it didn't really connect. She was also having some rough times in her private life, now divorced twice. Luckily, some important film directors, first Robert Altman, then Mike Nichols, recognized what talent she possessed and cast her in some remarkable, risky roles. The drama Silkwood, based on a true story of a nuclear plant worker who died under mysterious causes, starred Meryl Streep and Kurt Russell, plus Cher in a rare, heroic gay role. This was a radical departure for the woman America knew from the wacky Sonny and Cher show, and proved that we were just beginning to see what she could achieve. She received an Academy Award nomination and a Golden Globe win for the part. Gypsies, Tramps, and Thieves. We love Cher so much, we're even willing to disagree with her. She doesn't like this song, even though it is still part of her repertoire. But most will agree this tale of woe, told in a toe-tapping rhythm, is one of the best tunes that still dominates AM radio. The 1971 release was her first number one hit on the Billboard charts and secured her position as a solo artist. It's also a great one for karaoke. I do believe it was one of my first 45s also. Okay, number 7. Escorting the World's Loneliest Elephant Across Asia. In 2020, when most of the world was sealed up due to the COVID pandemic, Cher was flying around Asia fighting for Kevin, a depressed elephant stuck in a particularly nasty zoo in Pakistan. Cher met with Pakistan's prime minister, fought her way through red tape, and ultimately succeeded in winning the precious pachyderm his freedom. Then she escorted Kaven to a sanctuary in Cambodia, shooting a documentary for the Smithsonian Channel along the way. Those who were following along on social media may remember when she vowed, in all caps, "Can't wait to sing to him on the way to Cambodia. I have two songs." May we all have friends in our corner like Cher. Number 6 is believe. Fact. Anyone who has used autotune since Cher conquered the airwaves with Believe is wasting their time. Cher owns autotune like Franz Liszt owned the pianoforte, and everyone knows it. Believe, released in 1998, was Cher's 4th number one hit on the Billboard charts, 27 years after her first. Number 5, I gotta come down here and play pussyfoot with you. There are a lot of great Cher film performances, and obviously we're gonna get to the biggie soon, but one should not overlook 1985's Mask on her resume. Even if she recently called her director, the late Peter Bogdanovich, an a-hole and a pig, the two of them did great work together. Mask is based on the true story of Rocky Dennis, played by Eric Stoltz, a kid with a genetic order and facial disfigurement. It's a tremendous role for Cher, who gets to play a tough-as-brass Jewish mother in a biker gang. Talk about a badass combo. In the clip that's linked in the article, you can see her having absolutely no patience for a prejudicial school principal. For more of Cher reading authority figures for filth, there is a great scene opposite Andrew Robinson, another in a string of doctors giving her and Rocky the runaround. Number 4, they're giving a title of Cher's Men. Cher has provided chum to tabloids throughout her entire professional life, and given her no-nonsense demeanor, she seems to have made peace with this. Perhaps she even enjoys it. Her private life is none of our business, really, but it has been filled with high highs and low lows. Indeed, her marriage to Sonny Bono was, let's put this mildly, complicated, but it was clear she still had love for him when she gave his eulogy after he died while skiing. If you haven't watched her speech, it's a thing of tremendous, poignant humanity. The pop star's second marriage to psychedelic southern rocker Greg Allman did not last quite as long, but proved for a while anyway that love could cross over from opposite sides of the radio dial. And at the peak of her fame, the nation cheered when she hooked up Rob Camilletti, a.k.a. the Bagel Boy, a gorgeous Italian-American kid from Queens who was 18 years her junior. She even put him in a video. Number 3, snap out of it! Rarely does someone cement their legacy in cinema with a literal flick of the wrist, but that's what Cher did when she smacked Nicolas Cage across the face in 1987's Moonstruck. The Brooklyn-based Italian-American romp Moonstruck, written by an Irish-American playwright and directed by a Canadian, is one of the greatest romantic comedies ever filmed, and a lot of that is due to Cher's performance as Loretta Castorini, a widowed bookkeeper who has given up looking for love but can't stop love from looking for her. There are 102 minutes in Moonstruck, and every one of them is perfect. But the moment when Cher does her best to force Nick Cage to snap out of it is one that everyone rightly remembers. She won the Oscar for her role, and so did Olympia Dukakis for Best Supporting Actress and John Patrick Shanley for Best Original Screenplay. The Last Emperor won for Best Picture, and while that is absolutely a great movie, the fact that Moonstruck lost is one of life's great injustices. Number 2, the 1986 Bob Mackie dress. 2 years before Cher won the Oscar for Moonstruck, she was asked to present at the ceremony. she wore this dress, we're still talking about it. And number one, if I could turn back time, why is the sky blue? Why does the earth revolve around the sun? Why was Cher singing about time travel on a battleship in a fishnet bodysuit? These are the great mysteries of existence that are beyond questioning. In 1989, Cher, with the aid of songwriter Diane Warren, went from superstar to beyond all levels of superstar with this ubiquitous hit that topped charts around the globe. The accompanying music video, shot on a naval ship, got a few fuddy-duddies angry, but it certainly looks like all the sailors had a good time. We salute you, Cher. There we have it. Happy birthday, Cher. Her 10 most iconic moments, and it was by Jordan Huffman. Well, okay then, I can hardly believe it. Our time is up for Entertainment Weekly this week. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thank you for listening. Please come back next week to hear what I found from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is ew.com. And until then, goodbye.